The evening air is getting cooler. The days are getting shorter. I'm starting to sound like an amusement park commercial. It is autumn, grand, glorious autumn, arriving in all its resplendent glory. It is usually at this time of year when we decide to turn our thoughts to that magnificent holiday of Halloween. However, this year we are going down a different path indeed. If you have interest in some of the Halloween-themed subjects we have discussed, check out some of our previous October podcasts. Instead, this October, we are musing on the indoor pursuits that one's mind turns to when autumn approaches. When it becomes chillier outside in Ohio, we are no longer heading to the beach, unless that beach is hundreds or thousands of miles away. We've put the picnic table away and the lawn furniture. We've packed up the croquet set, which I'm sure everyone has run out and bought since our previous podcast from a few months ago. And we come inside to our homes or our apartments or our condos, and many of us return to our board games. Welcome to the Nordonia Hills Branch Library podcast on nonfiction, a discussion of nonfiction specifically and reading generally. This month's podcast, it's all a game. Board games and the act of playing board games is experiencing somewhat of a renaissance here these past 10 to 15 years. Some writers have theorized that it is because the need for human interaction is strong within all of us. And the loneliness of the small electronic screen is causing some people, quite a few people in fact, to seek out other more social activities. And board games fit the bill quite nicely. Board game sales in the United States have increased just about every year since 2005. A visit to the local big box store or to the specialty game store will reveal that there is a plethora of new games and more coming every year. Here at Nordonia Hills Branch Library, we have hosted a board game meetup every month since 2006, the third Saturday of each month, and it does respectable business. Usually between 15 and 30 individuals come out to play board games on these third Saturdays. So with the onset of the colder weather and this new interest in playing board games, this month we thought we would discuss three books that focus on the history and the playing of board games. Our first book is entitled It's All a Game: The History of Board Games from Monopoly to Settlers of Catan, written by Tristan Donovan. This is the most recent book of the three we'll discuss today, and it really is a nice all-in-one volume if you're interested in how some of the famous board games were developed over the years. Over the course of 16 chapters, he presents some very wonderful stories and anecdotes concerning the development of some of these major games. I'll talk about a few of them right now. Elizabeth Magee was born in Illinois in 1866. She was a modern-minded woman trapped in an older age. She worked, she wrote poetry and short stories, she dabbled in the theater, and she was also an inventor. At 26, she created a device for typewriters that was patented at a time when less than 1% of patents in the United States were owned by women. In 1902, she designed a board game that was meant to demonstrate a political and economic philosophy known as the single tax system. She called this game the Landlord's Game. In 1905, it was discovered by a professor of economics at the University of Pennsylvania named Scott Nearing. As students and teachers and their acquaintances and families played the landlord's game, they both customized their own versions of it, as well as tweaked rules to suit their purposes or to better the gameplay. Jump ahead 20 years to 1927, and a man by the name of Daniel Lehman, who was a student at a college in Massachusetts, discovered the landlord's game and introduced it to his friends. Encouraged by the positive response, he decided to have a bunch of copies made up and tried to sell it beginning in 1932. However, he relabeled the game Finance. But one of the people who played Finance was a lady by the name of Ruth Hoskins. When she went back to Atlantic City, she made up a copy of the game herself. Reflecting her surroundings in Atlantic City, she made the fifth house of the game into a hotel instead. And she relabeled all the spaces with some of the street names from Atlantic City. This Atlantic City version of Monopoly spread to nearby Philadelphia, where it was discovered by a man named Charles Todd and his wife Olive. They had a friend named Charles Darrow. Darrow came over to play the game one night at the Todds' house, asked for a copy to be made up for him, which the Todds did. Once Darrow took his copy of the game, he and Charles Todd never spoke again. Todd was bewildered by the sudden loss of contact from Mr. Darrow, but then all of a sudden he spotted a poster announcing that Charles Darrow would be demonstrating his new game called Monopoly at a local bank. Darrow had had the game spruced up by a local cartoonist, adding new artwork and more color, and then persuaded the Wanamaker's department store to begin carrying the game in downtown Philadelphia. Soon after, FAO Schwartz added it, and Darrow began making inquiries of the two biggest board game manufacturers, Parker Brothers and Milton Bradley. Both companies turned him down. By the fall of 1934, however, both the department stores had sold out of their game and ordered more copies. Darrow paid for another 7,500 copies, and they sold those out as well. When word of these sales got back to Parker Brothers, they came back to Darrow and asked to buy the game after all. When Parker Brothers bought the game from Darrow, they of course asked him whether or not he had all the rights to the game by himself, and he was the sole owner of those rights. And Darrow, of course, kind of lied and said, "Oh yes, I am." When Parker Brothers put it into mass production and started selling it on a wider scale, they soon found out, through their lawyers, that they had a problem. Elizabeth Magee had patented the landlord's game, and that patent was still in active force. So Parker Brothers had a lot of work that they had to do in order to secure the rights and to clear out all the possible confusion from the game that they now called Monopoly. In World War II, the British Intelligence Agency approached Waddington's, which is a British game manufacturer that had the rights to make Monopoly in the United Kingdom, and requested that they produce special editions of Monopoly to be shipped to prisoners of war. So as part of a very secret program, Waddington's began to produce versions of Monopoly that were to be sent to prisoners of war within their internment camps. These special Monopoly boards would have a small compass, two files, and a silk map of the area hidden within the game board and its components. Now, the story of Monopoly's development, as well as the use of Monopoly within the war effort, are actually contained in two separate chapters, because he does include a chapter just on spying and game use within wartime. He also touches on the Russian chess program during the Cold War. People came back home after World War II and settled down, and board games took off even more than they had previously. A British game was developed in the 1940s and was eventually published in 1949, called Cluedo. Its inventor had originally called his game design Murder, but Waddington's thought that that was not suitable for public sale, so they changed it to the word Cluedo, which they developed by fusing the words clue with the word ludo, which is Latin for I play. They also changed some of the spaces on the game board. For example, the designer, Mr. Pratt, had a room on the board called the gun room. They changed this into the dining room. Originally, Mr. Pratt had 10 guests at the mansion, and Waddington's turned him down to 6. Colonel Yellow became Colonel Mustard so as not to associate a military man with cowardice. So now Waddington's came to Parker Brothers and wanted to see them distribute Cluedo in the United States. Only problem is, Parker Brothers had a standing policy not to publish any kind of game that involved murder or killing. This rule had been laid down by George Parker, the founder of the company. But Robert Barton, who was the current president of Parker Brothers, the more he played the game, the more he was convinced it was going to be a hit. So he went to Mr. Parker and tried to convince him of such, and was eventually able to persuade him to release the game in the United States. Inevitably, Parker Brothers made more changes to the game from the British version. In the British version, the victim is Dr. Black. Parker Brothers changed the name of the victim in the U.S. version to Mr. Body. And Reverend Green from the British version became plain old Mr. Green in the American version. They also changed the rule book to change the word the murder to the act. Clue became Parker Brothers' top-selling game in 1949, with 13,000 copies sold. By 1975, the company was selling an average of 2 million copies of Clue every year. There is a reason why that game isn't just about everybody's basement. There's also the whimsical story of a game within this book called King's Footsie. King's Footsie was designed to be a game played on a white plastic sheet divided into 25 squares, 1 foot each on a side. With 4 people being on the board simultaneously, the goal was to have each of the 2-member teams to get all 4 of their feet lined up in 4 consecutive squares, a 4 in a row, kind of like tic-tac-toe. The designer and inventor of this game approached a shoe polish company, thinking it would be a wonderful promotional item for the company to back, but the company turned him down. He then approached 3M. 3M turned him down. The inventor, Raine Geyer, worked for a design agency that designed store displays for retailers. He stuck his copy of King's Footsie up on a shelf in the agency's conference room. It was there where a salesman for a silkscreen company noticed it when he was in a meeting with another one of the agency's executives and asked, "What is that on the shelf?" The purchasing director explained that it was a game that Geyer had designed but wasn't doing anything with. The salesman, Chuck Foley, had worked in the toy business and asked to meet Mr. Geyer. After they were introduced, he explained that he until recently had been working for a toy manufacturer in Minneapolis and he knew the game business pretty well. Geyer hired Foley and a friend, and they began redesigning King's Footsie. One of the team's first moves was to replace the squares with rows of different colored circles. And then they created a spinner that dictated what color circle players had to put their feet on. Finally, the friend, Neil Rabens, came up with the idea of getting people to put their hands on the board also. They arranged a meeting with Milton Bradley, the game company, in 1965. Milton Bradley's vice president asked if he could keep the game so he could pitch it to his bosses. By this point, King's Footsie had also been renamed. It was now called Pretzel. A few weeks later, Milton Bradley called Geyer and said they wanted to buy it, but they were also going to change the name from Pretzel to Twister. Now, even though Milton Bradley had bought the game, within the company ranks, there was an internal struggle going on. Many people believed that a game like Twister, with its vague sexual overtones, had no business in a family-friendly games catalog for a company like Milton Bradley. By Christmas of 1965, Mel Taft, who was the vice president who had met with Geyer, called him to break the news that Milton Bradley was not going to include Twister in its annual Christmas catalog of games, and it was discontinuing production. Geyer was crushed. He was convinced that there was a successful game there if someone would just get the word out. Now, when Milton Bradley bought the game Twister, they did appropriate some money for public relations work or an ad campaign for it, and it had yet to be spent. But Taft, thinking it is one last chance to see how well the game might be, decided to spend the money that had already been appropriated anyway, and so he did. The PR team for Milton Bradley managed to get a copy to the hands of Johnny Carson, the legendary talk show host on The Tonight Show. And on May 3, 1966, Mel Taft and the public relations lady Ruth Miller was in the show's audience in New York City for the taping. During the show, Johnny's guest, the actress Eva Gabor, convinced Johnny to join her for a game of Twister. The sight of Carson in a suit and Gabor in her dress tying themselves into knots on the mat caused the audience to burst out laughing and caught the attention of millions of viewers nationwide. The next morning, people in the United States started hunting for Twister. By the end of 1966, Milton Bradley had sold over 5 million copies of Twister. These stories and many others are contained in this wonderful book. It is well written in a very conversational style and is highly recommended. Two other books that you may want to take a look at include Family Games, The 100 Best, edited by James Lowder, in which today's top board game designers and publishers each take on a favorite game of their own and describe why it should be your favorite game as well. The essays on each game run about 3 to 4 pages, and for a single volume, it contains so much wonderful information about 100 different games, it definitely will help you decide where your game-buying dollar might go to the next time you're in the market for a board game. Our last book is a very slim little volume called Things We Think About Games by Will Hinmarch and Jeff Tidball. This book contains invented aphorisms and wisdom about board games and game playing, as well as general advice for people as they approach board games. Things such as life is too short to play bad games or give the gift of gaming. Games make great presents even for folks who don't think of themselves as gamers. So as the Ohio air continues to cool as we approach our dread winter, think of it as an opportunity to get to know your friends and family better. Break out those board games, whether they be the old standards or new ones that you may have discovered, and learn the wonderful social interaction that games can provide. Learn something new about yourself, learn something new about your fellow opponents, and generally, just have a good time. When you get right down to it, it's all a game. Join us again next month for another topic on nonfiction. And be sure to stop in every third Saturday of the month for our game time from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., a monthly gathering of board game enthusiasts. Meet some new friends, learn some new games, have a good time. All at your Nordonia Hills Branch Library. Music by 20 Riverside, provided by Mevio's Music Alley. Music.mevio.com. Thank you very much for listening, and happy Halloween.